Hello and welcome to this miracle podcast from Serpentine Galleries, part of a series of audio explorations on the subject of miracles, including audio dramas, live musical performances, poetry and discussions. All of the material in this series was originally recorded at or produced for the Serpentine's Miracle Marathon Festival 2016. I'm Tabitha Thorley-Bangora, and with me is Lucia Pietristi, Public Programmes Curator at the Serpentine.
Hi, Tabitha.
Hi, Lucia. Today's miracle is by Martine Sims. Martine Sims is a conceptual entrepreneur, lecturer and artist based in Los Angeles. This is a piece called Solitude, starring Aaliyah Parsons as the narrator. It was produced by Joby Wardman and has a soundtrack by Benedek.
When we first spoke with Martine in the preparation of the Miracle Marathon, she mentioned a really profound interest in Octavia Butler, and I think this piece very much grows out of that. She's described it in a text which I'm going to read for you here. So she writes, "Solitude is a lyrical radio documentary that explores the future of Altadena, California, a model city in post-industrial urban America located 14 miles northeast of downtown Los Angeles. In the 1850s, Altadena was a resort town for Eastern millionaires from the Wrigleys to the Scripps to the Gillettes. The unincorporated area had a libertarian slant and was a functioning utopia for the radical elite. Kate Crane Guards held salons for socialist thoughts, and Zane Grey threw legendary parties on his palatial estate. However, long before real estate developers, quote, discovered the area, Mexicanos, homesteaders and squatters occupied the canyons. Displaced blacks began moving to Altadena in the 1950s because the area was committed to integration and had an open housing covenant that welcomed people of color. Zora Neale Hurston wrote Dust Tracks on a Road while living in Altadena. Alice Walker was once a resident. Octavia Butler grew up on Tremont Street. Altadena embodies a collision of influences, histories, and ideologies. Solitude looks at the township as a site of encounter between radical politics and black imagination. I'm interested, writes Martine, in the ways that visions of the future change in response to contemporary life and to social conditions. Inspired by Kodjo Eshin's formulation, I want to recast science fiction in the light of Afro-diasporic history. Altadena is currently experiencing a renaissance with a white urban homesteader and survivalist movement. Its black population is shrinking for the first time in 50 years. Using Glenn Gould's contrapuntal technique, I want to consider how African Americans fit into this future. So here's Martine Sims's Solitude.
Can you find utopia? Can you find utopia? Can you find utopia? Can you find utopia? Junie is a relic. She lives in Altadena in a ranch-style house on El Molino. She's comfortably asocial, a hermit living in a city, a pessimist if she's not careful, a student, endlessly curious, a feminist, an African-American, a former Baptist, and an oil and water combination of ambition, laziness, insecurity, certainty, and drive. Every morning she rises at first sunlight. She pulls on dark pants and a heavy shirt. Inside the house, she wears black sneakers, the unfashionable kind. On the porch is a second pair, outdoor shoes. She takes different routes on her walks, but it's always up, up towards the mountains. The San Gabriels are beautiful at dawn, and she likes to be out in their shadow. The stoplights no longer work, and there are few cars. Some days she beelines. Others, she zigzags. Her favorite route is across Woodbury, up Windsor, towards the Gabrielino Trail. If she's been a good girl on her walk and not stopped off for a donut, she treats herself to a copy of the paper. If not, she gets the news on the radio and from her neighbors if necessary. The community is less populous, certainly, but its residents outlive the rest of California by a wide margin. By the last official count, the area is 40% white, 27% Latino, 27% Black, and 6% Asian. This is utopia to some. The H5 virus was swift. It spread like wildfire once it got into the water supply. After the outbreak, it was even harder to move around Los Angeles. The congestion moved from the street to the body, and everything stopped. When the vaccine stopped working, the survivors began to protest. As the death count grew, the National Guard was called to restore order. Altadena was protected by a paramilitary group. They bombed the bridges, so the only way into town was through the Angeles National Forest. The mountains were filled with armed squatters. They'd been there and were prepared to stay. Junie was born after it all happened. She is a teacher. People walk with her, and she shows them how to make oneself at home anywhere. She calls it the school of I will survive. Lately, she's been feeling dis-ease. And it's not the virus. She thinks it's ontological indigestion. Her walks begin with a brief history lesson. She talks about the so-called Gabrielino and the Hahamogna tribe. She's assembled a piecemeal archive of Altadena. There are gaps. The absences look like her. Every third Sunday, she has a class. It starts in the late morning. They convene around a trailhead at the end of Altadena Drive. She arrives early to prepare. One by one, her followers begin to appear. They look tired, hungry, and scared, as if the hours they plan to spend together will be their last. She wonders how they found her. Each one approaches and presents the item they want to trade for her knowledge. She's never turned anyone down. Today she gets a knife, incense, flower, and a pair of earrings.
Why are you here? That's okay. No one ever knows. I'm going to pass around a notebook and a pencil. Fill a page with what you do know and mark it October 9th.
Junie learned the knowledge from her father. He grew up with nothing, so he knew how to make everything himself. She wanted that. She was raised nearby. She knows the mountains. She spent every day swimming in the waterfalls, hiking, climbing rocks, pretending she was in another time. Her father had been the head of a neighborhood committee when he was alive. Every year at the annual gathering, he said the same thing. If anything happens, if there's a disaster, if the city shuts down, we are on our own up here. There's no such thing as an emergency if you're prepared. The Hahamogna didn't have a word for lost. When they come across an edible plant, she slows down. She stands in front of the growth and asks,
"Do you know what this is?"
80 years ago.
That's okay. No one ever knows.
In the first mile, they find buckwheat, mustard, and prickly pear cactus. Junie takes the dry buckwheat leaves and grinds them in her palm. She wants the seeds. When the grain becomes a fine dust, she puts it in a small cotton bag. When they reach camp, she'll mix it with the flour and cook biscuits. She lets a bald man crush and carry the mustard. They nibble on a few leaves before continuing. What more do you need? The cactus is harder to get. She doesn't trust them enough yet. She grabs at the fruit and cuts a few pads with her knife. She stabs the fleshy part and holds it up while she demonstrates how to remove the barbs. No one else wants to try. She takes a dramatic bite. It tastes like a sour green pepper. She slices off a chunk and passes it around. The sun is directly above them, and she doesn't want anyone getting heat stroke. They're too far from the road now. They rest in the shade, and she tells them about Robert Owens. Owens was the richest black man in Los Angeles. He made his money providing wood and such for the U.S. Army. They're close to El Preto, where he lived. She looks around, trying to imagine his world.
Was he the only one?
Junie picks an everlasting flower. The syrupy smell reminds her of her mother.
Helichrysum periolare, medicinal. Drink as a tea to treat asthma and chest problems. The leaves can be applied directly to wounds.
Junie gathers yucca leaves on the way. She wants to teach them how to make soap. When she's not walking, she's writing her history. She doesn't want to be forgotten, and she doesn't want to forget. It's survival of another kind. I will survive.
Hush up, child, and don't you cry. Your folks might...
One of her followers, a chatty old woman, points out Sweet Bay. Junie eyes her with curiosity.
You're right, that is a bay plant. Take a handful. We can make tea from the leaves and roast the nuts. This is all new growth. Before the epidemic, there was a brush fire. We have to be careful with any loose embers. One stray spark and it's all gone.
When they get to the stream, Junie takes off her pack and climbs into the water. She lies down on her back and closes her eyes. Her followers stare. They've gathered around the edge. Some sit on rocks. They still look tired, hungry, and afraid, but less so.
Aren't you guys hot?
Her clothes will be dry as soon as they start walking again. She sits up, brings her hands together, and slurps the water. She splashes her face a few times and leans back. A few of the followers dip their hands in the water, too. A few others pour water over their heads. They're getting comfortable with each other. Finally, they make their way to camp. They forage for dinner.
Curly dog. High in beta carotene, vitamin C, and zinc. Goosefoot, diamond leaves and reddish stalk. Black nightshade berries. They look like currants but taste like tomatoes. Deadly nightshade berries look exactly the same but will kill you. And dandelion greens. The root can be used as a laxative.
When they get to the campgrounds, they start to build a shelter. They're a team now. Junie wants them to build a simple lean-to.
Yep.
Earlier, she harvested extra yucca rope to keep it together. The structure is low. The ridgepole is waist high, and the walls are 3 feet thick with wood. It takes 2 hours, with all of them working full steam. They create a bed of leaves, even though they have sleeping bags and blankets. She wants them to see how it's done. After they finish the shelter, they're ready to eat. They clear an area for food and dig a fire pit. She shows them how to make a bow with the alder and string. She passes out a few mule fat spindles and places boards and sockets on the ground for them to practice with. Soon, a young naturalist gets an ember. Junie carefully waves a hand over the coal because breath contains moisture. She deposits the ember into a nest of dried cottonwood bark, softly blowing until the wood catches flame. The group erupts in applause. They make buckwheat biscuits and cooked greens. She grabs the sausages from her bag. They need protein after the long walk. It's sunset. The sky is a marvelous dusky pink. They eat and drink wine. They're friends now, at least for tonight. When the time is right, Junie reads from her notebook. She doesn't want them to forget.
In Altadena, they have found those qualities that make life worth living. Here, they might find the privacy and solitude of the country, which have always been a necessity for their work, and at the same time, all the conveniences and improvements that a city could yield without the undesirable phases of city government
and taxation. For the children, the best of schools were available and convenient. The greatest appeal has always been the beauty abiding here. Every window provides a magnificent view. To the north, the great mountains sweep on. On a clear day, they can see south to the ocean and the peaks of Catalina. Everywhere is warm, dry sunshine, the fragrance of innumerable flowers. Altadena is a place of personal paradise, a little piece of the California dream. The locals feel it is their right, and they guard it jealously. This is not so unusual. Doesn't everyone want this, really? A place of one's own, to be left alone. It's high ground, 13 miles northeast of downtown Los Angeles. The land is arable, a tangle of post-war tract housing mixed with Victorian farmhouses, craftsman-style bungalows, and once glorious estates. Altadena is an unincorporated suburb that sits between wilderness and city. The boulevards are lined in deodars, imported from the Himalayas by the banker John Woodbury. Foothills surround the area, swelling in the background of every view. Around dusk, the coyotes and mountain lions stalk the neighborhoods, inspiring fear, folklore, and gunshots. It's a sensual city. Negroes have long lived in Altadena. In the early morning light, the clear blue skies outlined the dark mountains. Clouds rested on the peaks. The real world is not this beautiful or tranquil. Robert Owens was a former slave, born in North Carolina, who bought his freedom and arrived in Los Angeles from Texas. There were perhaps 50 black people in Los Angeles County. Owens quickly carved out a niche for himself, supplying wood, building materials, and livery services to the United States Army. He logged the area that became known as Black Mountain or Nigger Canyon that branches off the upper Arroyo Seco to the northeast and becomes part of Millard Canyon, and built himself a cabin there in its upper reaches. Owens soon earned enough to buy his family back in Texas out of slavery. His wife and three children joined him in the hills above the future Altadena. They were enthralled by the beauty of the Arroyo and the charm of the house. It seemed incredible that they could live in one of the largest metropolitan areas in the country and be able to walk for 10 minutes and see deer running through high green grass. Distrust of authority and of government is an Altadena tradition. Its citizens were and remain libertarian in outlook. They don't want anyone snooping around their converted garages, regulating domesticated animals, or telling them where to live. The population is heterogeneous, mostly, contentious and fiercely private. They don't trust their neighbors either. There was little sense that the two former Black Panthers were anything other than ordinary men. Vaudreau, 64, was a regular at Print and Copy in Altadena, where he printed thousands of flyers for political events. Recently, he had made copies of a pamphlet titled Torture Methods Similar to Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib Used Against Members of the Black Panther Party. Altadena, has a long history of racial integration and a live-and-let-live attitude. It also was where former Black Panther and writer Eldridge Cleaver was buried after his death in 1998. Their politics are still the same. It's just that they are not active. Freedom of thought is so intimately connected with man's happiness and dignity that it is more important than the preservation of the Constitution. They all know what happened to the Constitution during the war. It was a scrap of paper, in very truth. Those who were confident of its guarantees took a great risk when they defied the war hysteria and stood by and for the Constitution and landed in jail. The very worst war is the war against words. And that is what is happening in California. If they don't like our words, why do they not answer with better words instead of clapping us in jail? They cannot. They know our protests are too real, too true, too fundamental. And by this inhuman, uncivilized treatment, they only augment the righteous discontent and add to our numbers. In Altadena, they have found those qualities that make life worth living.
Thank you for listening to this Miracle podcast. For more Serpentine Radio podcasts, please visit radio.serpentinegalleries.org.